What's going on, Ryan? Can you hear us?
Hello.
Ryan! Woo! Did you get into the Fool's Fest?
I'm late to every party these days. Now, I haven't gotten to a single tournament in the last, like, I don't know, 36 days, maybe?
Yep.
I'm sure I can sympathize with most people.
Most of our conversation tonight has been about getting into or not getting into the Fool's Fest.
Registration opened up at 8 o'clock, and half of us, actually three of the four of us were registered while we were recording.
Are you kidding?
It sold out.
Oh, yeah.
Obviously. Wow.
How many minutes?
Well, it's unclear. Adam will be able to, we'll hear the answer tomorrow, because even the AM days, even the Saturday AM day, which is the one that we were sort of shorting, because there are spots there, there's a deep wait list already for that.
Ooh, wow.
So, like, it looks like there are spots, but the wait list is like 20 deep, so that is technically sold out.
Yeah, pro days like that too.
Yeah.
Wow. And so you're doing 72 each day, or how? What's the breakup? I'm sure you've already been over this.
Yeah. So it's 72 on the pro day, which includes MPO and all pro divisions, and then the weekend before is AM weekend. So on Saturday it's MA1, MA40, MA50.
It was just all the advanced men on Saturday.
Yeah.
MA1, MA40, MA50.
Right.
And then the women in AM2 and 3.
Yeah, that's on Sunday. Because they're all playing the shorter layout. On Saturday, they're all playing the white. So it's MA1, 40, and 50. And Sunday's everybody the 2, 3.
Since when is there a short layout at FDR, though? Aren't they like the same distance-wise?
No. At its longest, the short layout was about 6,000 feet.
Okay.
It's been shortened over the course of the last year. And when I say shortened, I don't mean we, you know, shortened the pin locations. I mean, we, FDR had three holes in it in the yellow layout that were longer than their white counterpart.
I can see how that could be confusing.
Right. So it was an experiment that didn't work. So we swapped those so that those longer positions are all in the long layout. So the long layout was about 8,000 feet. So 6 and 8 was what it's basically been since we put the second set of pins in.
Okay.
So
that's noticeably longer.
How closer to like 5 and 9?
I would say like 50. It's not all the way down to 5. So we didn't shave it. I would say maybe it's down to like 56 and 84.
Okay. That makes sense. You know, I haven't played FDR in about, I'd have to say maybe 2 years, and I cannot wait to come back.
Yep. Come see me, dog.
Looking forward to it. So the Lost Valley Open, which was down in Pennsylvania last year, the tournament director did a lot of the pre-meets, like the players' meetings, like on his own Facebook page, and sort of advertised it relatively locally. And so if you were just like trying to participate from out of state and you were, you know, just checking into disc golf scene, I mean, you didn't get half of the information you needed to. And then on the tournament day, the player's guide, like the caddy guide, was supposed to be available online, but like the URL didn't work. And so it was like very difficult for, you know, out-of-staters to join and find out what was going on. And Andrew Fish actually, like, apparently that was like a complaint that he had, because he sort of fit that bill where he was like, you know, a pro trying to compete in this tournament, and he couldn't find any information about the tournament, you know. And it's tough, you know. You should make, as a matter of rule, anything that you make available to your Facebook, you know, anything on Facebook should be available via email or available on Disc Golf Scene.
And I think in that's one way or another. I think he relied a little too much on Facebook.
On Facebook. And that's not, yeah, not good form. Not good form.
It should be in both.
And I think to make matters worse, I might just totally be missing the Facebook page, but I don't know of a like Lehigh Valley Facebook page for disc golf. Does that exist, Ryan?
Oh my goodness. Yeah. And it's like 2,500 members strong.
Okay, so as you can tell, I'm not great at finding information on the internet. So if I can find it, it's foolproof.
Oh, man, that's funny. But it is, yeah. You know, I will say it is interesting. So I'm down in Florida right now, and I was trying to figure out, like, okay, well, where? So I'm outside of Orlando, and I want to play a competitive round. I have, like, I'm just on Google. I'm on Facebook. I'm, like, searching, like, Orlando Disc Golf Club, and I'm going on posts. And there's no way to get, like, a centralized view of, like, where weeklies are. And like, yeah. If you're just on vacation, and it's infuriating. And you know what?
UDisc?
You know, no,
the events page on UDisc isn't working.
I tried that, but most clubs don't run their stuff on UDisc yet. Eventually they will get there. The problem is that UDisc, you have to make it a league. You have to make it publicly accessible, and you can't do single day events. And it's very rigorous. Like, I feel like if they were to make their league function a little bit more user-friendly, then it would be all-encompassing, and everybody could use it.
I think what happened was they did early on, and my guess would be that they just got hammered with
league requests. Everybody wants to try it.
Yeah,
right.
So I didn't realize that, because when I did my league back in the fall, you could do it. Now you have to – it's kind of like when you're sending them a layout for a course. You have to send them an email requesting – you know, this is the name of the league. This is what I'd like to do. Yada, yada, yada. So it's, you know.
So, Jamin, when you came down to the Lost Valley, did you experience that where you couldn't find out any information about it?
I'm friends with him on Facebook, so I didn't. But
but that's the why.
Yeah. No, I have listened, but yeah. I get how that would be a huge problem. I would love playing tournaments down there, but I can never find any information on anything because I'm dumb with Facebook.
Yeah, and that shouldn't
Facebook
be a barrier
is hard
to entry.
To find information on sometimes
it is. That's the downside to it tailoring its services to you. It keeps everything very local to you.
Unless Jeff Wychowski's posting about the Nick and Matt show.
You know, I find that information really easy to come by.
That's it. Well, Ryan, what hole?
Let's go to hole 12. No, 13.
Good answer.
Two-part question.
Do you have 40 minutes?
No. This is probably a quick one. Do you think that they could make a disc golf basket that fits into the pin on a disc golf course? And if they could, is that just too damn long to play to be fun?
Fit a basket into the pin of a disc golf course? Wait, say that again.
They wouldn't let you muck up their greens.
It's all hypothetical.
I love throwing rollers on the golf courses.
Yeah.
Well, okay. So a couple things.
Into the cup, you mean? Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Right. Yep.
Is it too long to play a disc golf hole on, say, a par four ball golf?
Yeah.
Hole. Okay. Interesting. So I will say I have played a course, Mulligan's Creekside in Utah, which is part of, I assume, going to be part of Worlds, is basically that. Like, you're basically playing on the tees of the golf course and throwing sort of three quarters of the way down the fairway on the golf green or on the golf fairway, like towards, like, you know, a area of the rough that's like close to the water. And I will say that course sucks. It's like, your discs skip like crazy on the green, and like I'm talking like 80 feet. Like I'll throw a Thunderbird and think, oh, it's a great shot, and all of a sudden it's in the water. And I'm like, this is just garbage. So I think that the distance is, I think, a little too long. But I also think that golf fairways are not conducive to disc golf. They're too skippy.
So, Pat, are you aware also locally about we have exactly that? Colonial Acres was just south of Albany. 9-hole executive little par 3 golf course. They put in disc golf and they followed the golf fairways pretty closely. It didn't do well. He tried to charge to play. It's only 10-15 minutes north of Jay Park. No one's going to pay $5 to play boring ball golf, disc golf. And, you know, when they can go to Jay 10 minutes down the road for free.
I spend a lot of time in course design forums. And It's like an albatross. The piece of property that course designers least want is a ball golf course.
Yeah, we've worked a little bit on redesigning this Colonial Lakers to now, like, some of the holes were okay, but we took the whole middle and just took it and turned it 90 degrees.
Absolutely.
Fairway, because the ball golf went under. So we have the whole property now.
Yep. So Jeff Sullivan and I got Calverton on Long Island. And it was a links course, so, you know, not a real baller golf course to begin with, but it had great woods, like separating fairways and on the perimeter, we got really lucky with it. But generally speaking, you know, designers don't want a ball golf course because most of them are severely short on fairway defining elements.
Exactly.
What do you think, Jamin, of Steel Club in the Lehigh Valley?
I think the Steel Club has worked really well because that looks like a horrible actual golf course.
That's what you need. That is what you need.
It is a horrible golf course. It's like you have to climb halfway up a mountain.
Yeah. So I don't know if anybody else besides Ryan and I have played it, but some of the fairways are like pitched 30 degrees left to right.
Mm-hmm. Oh, wow.
I can't imagine playing on it with anything but a square like golf ball. And I'm not exaggerating with those angles. They're severe and it's everywhere. It's huge elevation. So it's perfect for a disc golf course, but for actual golf, it seems completely unpractical.
Yeah. I was going to say, I think that that property is actually very conducive to a good course. And I know that Steve's making a little bit more changes to it with a lot of input from others. And I really think that that's going to be a great course once it's sort of situated. I mean, they have a couple of signature holes already. 18's fantastic.
18's a great hole. Yeah. I mean,
it's just a phenomenal hole. I would say Old Three as well. Old Three was a par five that you had to go, I'd say, you're basically playing between two holes. You have to start and go up a tunnel about 250 just to land on the tee pad of the golf hole. And then you have to throw over a green to get to, like, a golf green to get to the woods behind the golf green where the actual basket is. And it's a par five. Like, getting that second shot over there is a crush. I'd say easily 400, maybe 450. And
at least
on the left side of the green is just, I would say, 150-foot hill. Like,
yeah, and it's super pitched.
Yep.
Yeah, you could lose a minivan in there. I really liked that change for tournament play because that hole took forever.
Ever, yeah.
And it was the third hole on the course. It didn't set up for a good day of golf.
Yeah, it did not. But when you have the time, it's a really interesting hole because your second shot, if you nail your first shot, you're on the tee pad, which is where they put the basket during tournament play. You still have a very difficult second shot because you've got so much angle sloping to the left and the green is obviously OB. So it's a really interesting hole.
Very tight landing zone. I do really like that hole. I was a little bummed when I came out last year and it wasn't there, but I totally understood why. And the shorter version of Hole Three was a good hole too.
It was. Yep. For sure. Also a huge sloping hill down next to the basket. So again, it's an excellent golf course for disc golf.
Yeah. I birdied that hole because I didn't know what I was throwing at.
That's the best. And then it's tough to repeat it the second round.
Oh yeah. Did not do it. Laid up from like 20 feet away.
That's great. Pat, does that answer your first part of the question?
Well, I don't remember the question.
I told you, do you have 40 minutes?
Yeah, no, it's cool.
And that was before hearing it.
All right, Jack, what hole are we playing?
Let's skip straight to nine, hole nine, because I got to go back to my car for a beer.
Oh, well, this is probably not a good one for you particularly, but what other disc golf podcasts do you listen to? You notice I say what other. What other disc golf podcasts?
Pat, you know I only listen to the Hudson Valley Disc Golf Podcast. I skim other disc golf podcasts. I'd listen to Nick and Matt. And, you know, I have alerts on, so I'll listen to any podcast that John Houck ends up on, because I love hearing him talk about design, or Chuck Kennedy. But I've heard them on many podcasts, but I couldn't off the top of my head tell you what that podcast was.
That's cool. What about you, Kenji?
I listen to the Nick and Mac show. I listen to the Nate Sexton Run It one. What else do I listen to? I used to listen to the PDGA one, and they kind of stopped. The one guy left. Other ones I've been listening to. I listened to the Scott Stokely one, the first couple. So-so. Disc Golf Answer Man here and there. What's else? The other dynamic disc one, the new one that Eric McCabe.
On the box?
Was it McTaco? Two guys, Eric McCabe and his buddy there, doing one. What else do I listen to? Just going through my podcast list on Spotify. You know, I just hit follow, and I listen to it when I do work on the weekends or while I'm working here and there. Been liking the Nate Sexton one.
Nice. Jamin?
The podcast that I've been listening to a lot lately is The Flight Diary with Brian Earhart. It used to be called The Buzz. He does some really great interviews. He recently posted a two-parter with Paul Macbeth that is like really, really good. You hear a lot of stuff about Paul Macbeth that you never would have heard of otherwise.
Nice. Yeah, I'll be interested to see at what point Fool's Fest actually sold out. It's a little complex to watch it live and try and figure it out.
Yeah, I feel like it happened in the first 3 minutes. I was counting the wait list for pro selling it out. I mean, if you don't look at that, there's still like 12 spots opening on the pro day, but it's just FPO.
Yeah, somebody on the Wedge site is reporting that Sunday AM day filled in 2 minutes.
Yeah. Is that you? Because that's your guess?
Well, somebody else is reporting that it sold out at 30 seconds. They were number 5 on the wait list.
Gotcha. Well, that could, both of those could be true.
Yeah.
This is Fool's Fest.
This is Fool's Fest. Yep.
Wow. It's getting pretty crazy out here.
Yeah. I mean, and this was one of the things that, this is one of the subjects that I'd like to talk about, like, a lot going forward, because there are lots of great solutions to be implemented for this.
Very few people to do them.
But there also has to be a realization that, you know, these events have zero competition when they go up. And when I say zero competition, I don't just mean from other disc golf events. I mean, you don't have your niece's birthday party. You don't have your bowling league. You don't have you're not playing disc golf 3 weekends this month, honey, type of competition for your time. So when these events come up, they're the only game in town. And, you know, everybody within 100 miles is trying to get into the thing. I think that changes when the pandemic becomes under control. But the sport was headed towards congestion anyway. And the existing infrastructure, and when I say that, I mean existing people who run events, TDs, league runners, etc., they're already maxed. They should not be expected to ghost groups, you know, add new holes.
Days.
Like, you're taking a guy who is, you know, not just giving up his Saturday to run the event, probably given up the event to run the event.
Right.
But, you know, also puts, you know, hours of work into managing registration and promoting the event and sanctioning the event. And then afterwards, there's reporting on the event. It's not reasonable to ask these people to throw in an extra day. Mm-hmm. They're doing it anyway.
Stafford Open just did. They added a day.
And I just don't, it's not fair to existing event organizers to have to succumb to that pressure.
Everybody right now, at least in the discap land, there's a lot of people going, well, we need more events. And, you know, when Pat posted that workshop, somebody was like, oh, that's a good start. And so there's all these people who haven't actually helped yet with anything. And I'm sure that they're going to at some point, but they're, you know, even if they're just going to start helping, running a tournament immediately is not a great first step.
Absolutely. You know?
No, like, I would totally agree with you.
I'm just starting to feel confident enough to think that I'm qualified to do it. And that's after years of helping at events. And I've played in almost 100 PDGA tournaments. I've seen a lot of different ways that things can happen. Thank you.
Pat's got the stats. I love it.
Yeah. So that's just nice to have a statistician. It doesn't happen immediately. So some of you guys have heard me sort of think out loud about this, but the sport needs what I'm calling a culture of apprenticeship. And that's what's needed, actual apprenticeship. And it asks actually quite a lot of sort of both of the people involved in the apprenticeship. It asks, current TDs to recognize that they need help. It asks current TDs to spend time teaching, which is slower than doing.
Absolutely.
Right. But on the other end of it, it also asks, perky volunteers to recognize that they don't know how to do this. And, you can manage a business and you can manage employees and, you can run various organizations without having the slightest idea really how a tournament works and should work. And I think a lot of volunteers, come in enthused, but And don't get me wrong, it's not rocket science. I'm not trying to say that people can't do it. Anybody could do it.
What to do.
But it's knowing what to do, how to do it, how to avoid mistakes. And that's it. Culture of apprenticeship. Like we need volunteers that are willing to come in and say, I need to learn. And we need people at the top saying, I need to teach. It does put us a little bit away from real results, but it gets us there. And it's needed in disc golf, even in things like course maintenance and project development.
Oh, yeah.
Can I interject on the whole tournament directing for the first time thing? People shit on tournaments when they don't like
it's nuts.
Stupid things.
Yep.
Yeah.
Like things that are insignificant decisions that the tournament director may have made. Just generally speaking, like I feel like it's very intimidating to try directing a tournament for the first time because the community is very, very critical of decisions the tournament director makes. So I feel like we also don't create a very positive atmosphere for somebody trying it for the first time.
It's insane. It's absolutely insane. I've been there. I've run a lot of events and I've been in the line. These people end up, not just me, everybody. I mean, there are TD support groups on Facebook.
We're talking about the ice ball, and we're realizing we made mistakes there. We didn't, no players meeting, getting used to this whole tech challenge thing, second round that held us up.
Right, and you can't anticipate everything.
We're still learning.
But the idea that the community lambastes tournament directors, sometimes, sometimes for things that, are just unpopular with them and that aren't even mistakes. It's just a way that a tournament director has chosen to do something. There's a hostile environment out there. I agree with you 100%, Ryan.
I would recommend them first time TDs to do like one of those, what we call tournament in a box, base or, whatever the MVP challenge or the birdie bash or whatever manufacturer's little, look, we do all the back scenes stuff for you. You just kind of run the show. It's a great first step, especially with some help from an experienced person.
Yep.
To bounce questions off.
I just don't think it's something that experience helps. I think people are just hypercritical. I think it's like even if you're the most experienced in the world,
right,
you're still going to get crap. So you have to have such a thick skin to be a tournament director.
Yep.
Yeah.
That's a piece of culture that could change. Two, look, TD burnout is like, that's a real thing. Uh-huh. People do it one last time and they say, enough. But that's part of the culture that had better change too, if you're going to try and get more people running events with their free time for no money. Yep. I agree with you. It's obscene, the abuse that a TD can be exposed to. I will say and I like Kenji's tournament in a box. That is a great place to start.
For sure.
There's no reporting requirements.
Right. It's a lot. It's a good first step.
Yep. Mm-hmm. So Wedge is looking at developing an apprenticeship there where people who are interested in running events will start by signing on as an assistant tournament director. You know, we all know that anyone who's run an event knows that there's no shortage of help on the day. Mm-hmm. And that's just not the hard part. But whoever's running events for Wedge will be taking on a less experienced assistant tournament director and walking them through, you know, things like permitting and sanctioning and value proposition and, you know, correct entry fees and just all that stuff, the stuff that happens weeks before the event actually happens. And then when that person is ready to step up to be a TD, we'll plug in an experienced tournament director right behind them in the assistant TD spot so that they've got backup. And we're hoping to grow the pool of TDs in that way.
That's awesome. That's fantastic.
Because it is the only solution. Is more supply. It's a supply problem, and there are two possible solutions for a supply problem. There's less demand. You know, it's a scarcity. It's scarcity. So you can either reduce demand or you can increase supply. And you know, the little tricks that everybody's, you know, talking about, they're band-aids, ghosting a group or, and adding a day is the most unreasonable thing I can think of.
Yeah. Like in changing the day, adding a day, doing all this stuff.
Yeah.
I'm a firm believer in once you open registration, don't change a thing.
I agree with that.
Yes.
So, yeah. Right. And so like a 72 player field sells out and, you know, then you decide to, you know, either ghost groups or go to fivesomes. It's not what the original 72 people signed up for. I would not play in a tournament that has fivesomes. I might if I really gave the course some consideration and I said, okay, this course is wide open and it's also huge and, you know, it's not going to slow it down. But you run fivesomes at, you know, Kisco or even FDR. You're going to be waiting all day long.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that's a bad experience. I wouldn't sign up for that tournament, but I feel like you have to say up front, you know, it's fivesomes. If you run it out at 72, you got to keep it at 72.
I agree. Totally. That's about right. Night?
Next week on the Hudson Valley Disc Golf Podcast, should tournament directors get paid? Should tournaments raise prices?
Do you have 4 hours?
Yeah, do you have 4 hours?
Yes and yes.
Next week we'll have two.
Can I bring something random up?
Sure.
Yeah.
Did you guys see the new UDisc stats for professional analysis?
Is that the one where they had all the rounds played? I saw some.
Oh, man. Oh, I can't wait to talk about this. So they're introducing basically like Saber metrics for disc golf.
Ooh.
So what they're introducing is the concept of strokes gained in a specific category or skill set. So they will basically take, say, your circle 1x or your circle 2 putting percentages,
yeah,
and compare that to the average and see how many strokes you gained compared to the average player for that category. So for example,
right.
Remember when Ellen Widboom won a major or a big tournament this year, and it was like a come from behind victory? They will break down
right where she
exactly
did it.
How she did it. She gained, get this, 9 strokes on the putting green over the average.
Wow!
And that's compared impressive. To Katrina Allen, who lost a stroke.
That's not saying a lot.
But
still, you can see it. Yeah, that's great metrics.
It's great because cool. what it describes is what you're seeing, like the eye test. You know, Katrina Allen's a bad putter, and it costs her strokes. Now you have math to basically show it right. But also, like, it helps to define why somebody won a tournament. So, like Ellen Widboom, now you can look and say, man, her putting was outrageously good that tournament, and that's what won it for her. Right. So it's really, really cool. Fun. It's really interesting. And then they also have
circle 1, circle 2, scramble,
right.
And fairway hits.
Right. Well, it's actually strokes gained off the tee to the green. So here's another stat. Like Paige Pierce, 22 strokes above average, tee to green, but her gain putting was only 5. So you can yeah. kind of quantify
yep.
like where a player's strength is as a result. And awesome.
Obviously, you can also do that. You know, players can do that for themselves, so you right. know, they can see where right. where the game's falling apart or you know, where they need to devote their practice effort.
So how are they calculating that per event?
It's yeah, per event. I'm not sure if they're doing per round, but this is over the entire all the holes played in the tournament. This stat, at least for the analysis that I'm looking at. I'm not sure. Also interesting, they are introducing this stat to every single event that has ever been played on UDisc Live. So now we're going to be able to go back into the archives and see, you know, certain trends and performances, like figuring out what is the tournament in which a player's putting was the most important factor in their win.
Oh, that's cool.
That's going to be really interesting to see now that they're doing all the backdating, but I don't have the time to look at it. I hope UDisc does, or LT World, or somebody.
Somebody will, yeah. That's really yeah. cool.
Yeah, it's really awesome.
It starts to get rid of the arguments over who was best when and that kind of stuff. When was Ricky better than Paul and all those kind of questions that...
It's going to answer a lot of questions and it's going to create a lot of controversy. I can't wait.
Which is awesome. Yeah. All for it.
So we have to, the big events will have to get, maybe have to start paying staff to be scorekeepers to make sure those stats are accurate.
Yeah. That's the one thing where that kind of falls
right
apart.
Right now,
the
volunteer run, right? And sometimes maybe a little bit of interpretation comes into those stats. Not much.
Yeah.
I don't think a lot, but.
Well, if you think about just the idea of on the fairway or off the fairway, somewhere like the Country Club in Emporia.
That's the one. Yeah, that's the one that comes to my mind, too.
Yeah, that's easy to do at Emporia. But on Maple Hill, you know, where does the fairway end
yeah,
and
right.
the rough
right.
starts?
Right.
On hole 6, you could be in the middle of the fairway and be screwed.
Then it's open interpretation. And then
none of the stats, for the record, none of the stats have to do with fairway hits or anything.
Okay.
It's basically there's 5 of them. There's or 4. There's gains, gain tee to green, gain putting, gain C1X, and gain C2. And then there's like some OB calculation that contributes to your gain tee to green. So I guess your OB strokes matter, but on and off the fairway doesn't.
Gotcha.
Okay.
Neither does C2 or C1.
That takes out the interpretation or less, right?
If right,
you throw it
right,
off the fairway, but still yeah. throw it in the circle 1,
yeah.
you're good.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Good. It's very sound. And so if you want to nerd out, there's a, like a, that was, I just got all this from reading like their, you know, their beginner article about it, but then they have an in-depth, like, report on how they did it and show, you know, examples and stuff. So if like, I think that they're pretty sound in their analysis and everything. So I think it's going to be really cool.
That is cool.
This isn't like a math equation. This is somebody having to go in and do research, right?
Well, they did the research and they determined that these are, will be interesting statistics to add that are contributing to, you know, professional skill analysis. And it is based off a math equation. So there's okay. nothing other, like, as long as they have a couple of stats, all they need to produce this is basically like, did your drive land off the, like, out of bounds in C2 or in C1? And when did you hole out? That's like all they really need to produce these.
Right.
So all of the subjectivity outside of that is gone. So things like, were you out of bounds? Were you in C2? Were you in C1? I mean, you have everybody. I don't think that's up for interpretation. So I think it's a pretty right. sound statistic, at least.
Yeah. I wasn't wondering that. I'm more being selfish because Heiser Creek's tournament in the fall was on UDisc, and I was wondering if I could see why I suck.
Oh. I know why I suck.
We just kept the score only, right? You need to know circle 1,
well.
Circle 2.
Yeah, stats. I've still got a pretty good idea why, so I'll figure it out.